Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated February 12, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Wicker Work Inspired by Abraham. This is from the Together Decatur column by Donette Beckett. President Lincoln honored through Mount Zion woman's weaving. As Donna Johnson sought to honor the 16th president, particularly in light of his birthday today, she decided to draw on a craft she's been practicing for more than a decade, basket weaving. Johnson, a basket weaver from Mount Zion, fashioned some of her basket creations to look like a stovepipe hat, similar to the ones made popular by Lincoln. Johnson adds memorabilia or details such as cookie cutters, ribbons, or recipes. Lincoln's stovepipe hat wasn't just a fashion statement, according to 10 Facts About the Other Abe by Elizabeth Downing. He also used it to store and carry notes, letters, even bills. It was this inspiration that encouraged Johnson to honor Lincoln. He was 6'4". He surely didn't need any more height, Johnson said. Similar to Lincoln's hat, the wicker baskets made to resemble it can be used to hold memos and other office supplies. They would also make a great candy dish, Johnson said. Since the hat baskets are handmade, they range in size. They average about 1 foot tall and the base is about 10 inches wide. Johnson plans to make smaller baskets that would be an appropriate size for pens, pencils, and highlighters. Lincoln has become the focus of many Johnson pieces. Because of the historical and political aspects of being the state capital, Springfield has many tourists traveling through its downtown area. Johnson noticed one of the more popular shops had many nice items for sale, but few Lincoln pieces. Johnson was given the opportunity to display her baskets at the store, Studio on 6th. To her surprise, they sold quickly. The hats do well because they are different, she said, and I reduced my price. All of the items sold at Studio on 6th are made by local artists. Cynthia Wilkin is a booth owner and volunteer for the store. We look for quality artists as well as Illinois items, she said. Wilkin admired the unique hat baskets as well as Johnson's other products. They are sturdy and the variety is excellent, Wilkin said. She has Valentine's Day, Illini, and Cubs and Cardinals baskets with ribbons woven in them. She covers the gamut. Johnson soon will be adding her products to another shop, Expressions Gift and Consignment in Cerro Gordo. She has limited where her products are displayed so not to compete with her mentor, Bonnie Rideout. I have taken her classes for 15 years, Johnson said, and I get my supplies from her. Rideout has taught basket weaving classes since 1994. Johnson is just one of her many students. She was enthusiastic and always wanting to learn more, Rideout said of her student and friend. The teacher watched Johnson become more creative in her own style. One of her other popular pieces are the wall or door baskets, containers that can be hung on a flat surface. She continues to keep Lincoln as a theme, adding cookie cutters and wooden ornaments. Johnson creates most of her pieces using colored reeds. When you start weaving them, you have to manipulate it with hot, hot water. The black seems to be so much ornerier to bend, she said. It's not as pliable as the natural ones. And this Together Decatur column by Donette Beckett notes, do you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett@herald-review.com. And from the Illinois Bicentennial column, on the front page is an article titled, Defender Became National Voice. Minority Paper Influenced Migration to Illinois. On May 5, 1905, Robert Stengsack Abbott founded the Chicago Defender newspaper in a small kitchen in his landlord's apartment, with an initial investment of 25 cents and a press run of 300 copies. The Chicago Defender's first issues were in the form of four-page, six-column handbills filled with local news items gathered by Abbott and clippings from other newspapers. 5 years later, the Chicago Defender began to attract a national audience. By the start of World War I, the Chicago Defender was the nation's most influential black weekly newspaper, with more than two-thirds of its readership located outside of Chicago. During World War I, the paper utilized its influence to wage a successful campaign in support of the Great Migration. It published blazing editorials, articles, and cartoons lauding the benefits of the North, posted job listings and train schedules to facilitate relocation, and declared on May 15, 1917, as the date of the Great Northern Drive. The Chicago Defender's support of the Great Migration encouraged Southern readers to migrate to the North in record numbers. Between 1916 and 1918, at least 110,000 people migrated to Chicago, nearly tripling the city's black population. Following the war, the Defender covered controversial events, such as the Red Summer Riots of 1919, a series of race riots in cities across the country. The Chicago Defender campaigned for anti-lynching legislation and for integrated sports. In 1923, the Chicago Defender introduced the Bud Billiken page, the first newspaper section just for children. The Chicago Defender, along with the Chicago Defender Charities, is the producer and organizer of the world-famous Bud Billiken Day Parade and Picnic. The parade originated in 1929 as a vehicle to showcase children. Today, the Bud Billiken Parade is the largest event of its kind. Columnists at the Defender included Walter White and Langston Hughes. The paper also published the early works by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gwendolyn Brooks. Heralding itself as the world's greatest weekly, the Defender spoke out against segregation of the armed forces in the early 1940s and actively challenged segregation in the South during the Civil Rights era. In 1940, John H.H. Sendsack, Abbott's nephew and heir, assumed editorial control and continued to champion for equality. In 1956, the Chicago Defender began publishing on a daily basis. In 1965, Sendsack purchased the Pittsburgh Courier, including it in his Sendsack newspaper chain, along with papers such as the Michigan Chronicle in Detroit and the Tri-State Defender in Memphis. Sengstack served as publisher of the Defender until his death in May 1997. The Chicago Defender is the flagship publication of Real Times, Inc., a media company that also includes among its holdings the Michigan Chronicle, the Front Page, the New Pittsburgh Courier, and the Tri-State Defender. 104 years later, the Chicago Defender won the prestigious John B. Wusworm Award during 2009's National Newspaper Publishers Association Merit Awards Gala, along with two first place and two third place awards, including the John H. Sengstack General Excellence Award. And sidebars to the column, note that the Chicago Defender's homes were varied. They started in the landlady's kitchen table from 1905 to 1920, moved to South Indiana Avenue from 1920 to 1960, moved to 2400 South Michigan Avenue from 1960 to 2006, then to 200 South Michigan Avenue for the next 3 years, and finally from 2009 to the present, at 4445 South Martin Luther King Drive. And further notes that Chicago Defender's fifth and final home is owned and managed by East Lake Management, was once Metropolitan Funeral Home, sister company to the Metropolitan Assurance Company, and it's located four blocks from Defender founder Robert S. Abbott's mansion, which is a National Historic Landmark, located at 4742 South King Drive. And about this story, the weekly Illinois Bicentennial Series is a year-long project of the Illinois Associated Press Media Editors and Illinois Press Association. More than 20 newspapers are creating stories about the state's history, places, and key moments in advance of the bicentennial on December 3, 2018. Stories published up to this date can be found at 200illinois.com. And moving to the local and state page, Tony Reed writes from Decatur, DUI driver found by tire tracks. From Decatur, police followed tire marks in the snow to find and arrest a Decatur driver who now faces felony driving under the influence of alcohol charges. Sergeant Josh Sheets with Decatur Police said the 30-year-old driver was awakened out of bed by patrol officers who arrested him Monday night at his home on Caden Drive. That is located a few blocks from the 300 block of West Imboden Drive, where Sheets said the driver had earlier crashed his rented sport utility vehicle into a front yard after striking a power pole. Sheets said the driver had been drinking with friends at a house on Imboden Drive and was already intoxicated when he arrived. They played around wrestling, and apparently this suspect began taking it too seriously, which caused problems, and they ended up telling him to leave at 10:30 p.m., said Sheets. That's when he clipped the pole and plowed into the front yard of a neighboring home before driving off and leaving the vehicle's wing mirror assembly behind. Police were called at 10:45 p.m. and took the wing mirror with them as they followed the vehicle tire marks in the snow right to the driver's house. Sheets said the man, once awake, tried to tell officers he had been asleep the whole time and wasn't the suspect they thought. But police had the wing mirror and numerous witness reports and could see the damaged SUV parked in a garage. The driver, whom Sheets said has a previous DUI conviction, was booked on preliminary charges of aggravated DUI, DUI and leaving the scene of an accident, and failure to report an accident. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. And next, from Decatur, Tony Reed writes, Senior Night honors parents. Decatur ice hockey players score big on warmth and generosity. Amid the battle scars and bruises is a softer, gentler side to the men who go down to the ice armed with bent sticks to play the game of hockey. That tender sentiment was on full display Sunday evening, if only for a little while, as the Decatur Youth Hockey Association celebrated its senior night at the Ameren, Illinois Arena inside the Decatur Civic Center. Before the senior team took on the Morton IceHawks as their final season winds down, the six tough guys skated out bearing flowers as a salute for their moms. The players also had commemorative pucks to present to their dads as a way to mark their last hurrah before heading off to college and the rest of their lives. What will I miss the most? I'll miss the rest of the guys for sure, said goalie Will Horv, 18, a graduating senior at Maroa Forsyth High School. I'll miss game nights, hotel stays, they were a lot of fun. I've been playing this since I was four, and I enjoy the game because it's just so different from any other sport. He will soon become a Decatur Youth Hockey League alumni, and those alums turn out to be a very generous bunch of people. After the ceremony honoring parents came a check presentation to the American Cancer Society to the tune of more than $20,600, the proceeds of two annual alumni games, plus associated fundraising, held in November. This is the third year of the fundraiser to help out the charity, and it was the biggest check by far. How important is this to us? This is huge. "We have a great partnership with the Hockey Association," said Lara Grabowski, event lead for the American Cancer Society Relay for Life of Macon County. One new wrinkle on the ice, not too many players seem to have noticed so far, is that newly rechristened Ameren Illinois Arena they were presenting flowers and checks and skating on. The title change slid into place after the utility paid $27,000 for naming rights. "I'm not real sure, but yes, I did hear they were changing the name," said Kim Taylor, president of the Decatur Youth Hockey Association. "Well, regardless of the name, it's all about the kids and being able to come out and enjoy themselves and have a good time. As long as we have ice for our kids to play on, that's what's important." And a photograph accompanying the article shows three large teenage boys. Decatur Youth Hockey Association seniors Will Horve, left, Davis Little, and Dylan Harjung line up to present their moms with flowers and their fathers with commemorative pucks to mark their final season. The full senior team also includes Caden Brilly, Jack Franey, and Logan Shepherd. And next on the local and state page, Mississippi locks, dams will cost either way. Study: river closing would overload highways and railways. A new study suggests the failure of any one of 25 aging locks on the upper Mississippi River could result in nearly 500,000 truckloads of freight on highways between the Twin Cities and St. Louis. University of Wisconsin-Madison researchers estimate that a shutdown of the river at Hannibal, Missouri, would require more than 12 million tons of grain during a 9-month shipping season to be moved by truck, costing hundreds of millions of dollars and damaging already stressed roads. The vast majority of these shipments would travel through southern Minnesota and Iowa, while a smaller amount would move through Wisconsin and Illinois, according to the study, causing nearly $29 million in pavement damage. The study was funded by the 10 states of the Mid-America Freight Coalition, an organization dedicated to planning, operating, and improving transportation infrastructure in the Midwest. "We're talking about a system," said Ernest Perry, manager of the coalition and the lead researcher of the study. "If we don't take care of this one part of the system, it's going to negatively impact another part of the system." The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has estimated the backlogged maintenance costs for locks and dams of the Mississippi and Illinois rivers is more than $1 billion. Mostly built in the 1930s, many of the locks have reached the end of their service lives, and the inland waterway system has earned a D- from the American Society of Civil Engineers. The lock and dams between Winona and La Crosse are more than 80 years old. Brian Peterson, Navigation Business Line Manager for the St. Paul District, said over the past 5 years the river has been open about 99% of the time, with most closures resulting from vessels hitting the gates rather than mechanical failure. "It's always a potential," he said. "It's a pretty good record, but there's always that risk." In the event of a river closure, the study estimates about 1.4 million tons would originate from Winona and nearly 500,000 from La Crosse, which would result in more than 190 trucks per day traveling through Wisconsin on Interstate 90. Nearly 5.8 million tons coming from the Twin Cities and Red Wing would result in nearly 600 more trucks per day on Highway 52 through southern Minnesota and into Iowa. Researchers have previously assumed railroads would absorb most of the displaced shipments during a river shutdown. The study looked at scenarios in which trucking picks up 75 to 100% of the load. "While it's likely that more volume would move by rail," Perry said, "states were interested in seeing the impact on the roads." One 15-barge tow carries the equivalent of about 2 trains or more than 1,000 trucks. The study also focused only on agricultural products, though such products made up less than 30% of the total river volume in 2016, according to the Core data. Perry estimates the total costs of a season-long shutdown would be about $319.6 million, including the social costs of additional carbon dioxide emissions. The costs with failures in following years, he said, could begin to approach the $1 billion in deferred maintenance on the river. And from the dialogue page, our view. Communication is always the best option. When a fight broke out at MacArthur High School last March, Decatur school district officials responded by having a parent forum about the incident. School leaders said they needed to work on better communication so rumors and hearsay wouldn't fuel speculation. Nearly a year later, the district hasn't listened. On Wednesday, during a half day at school, there was another fight at MacArthur. Police responded. On YouTube, someone posted a video that claimed to show the chaos. Commenters on social media jumped on board, even though there were plenty of unknowns. For example, was that video showing what had happened on Wednesday, or was it something else, somewhere else, at some other school? The school district sent a short news release with the most bare of details. No information if students were seriously hurt, no information about arrests, no information about what comes next. Follow-up questions got terse responses. Questions to the Decatur police were directed back to the school district. It was bizarre. To parents, there was a legitimate concern this fight would overshadow the very real accomplishments of all the other kids who weren't involved. We agree. In this case, if the goal was to communicate with parents or ensure the community of safety, this was a curious approach, about the polar opposite of crisis management. What's our advice to the school district? When something like this happens, have a press conference and answer questions. Stream the press conference via Facebook Live and post on your website. Take that suggestion from a year ago. Side with having more communication. And next from the dialogue page, Jonah Goldberg, who is an editor-at-large of the National Review Online and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. In China, life is a job. Vita est laborum. That's Latin for life is a job. I didn't learn that in school or even from a book. I learned that from Father Guido Sarducci. For young readers, that name may draw a blank. Father Guido wasn't a real person. He was a fictional priest played by comedian and writer Don Novello and was a regular guest on Saturday Night Live. In the 1970s and 80s. His most famous routine involved explaining how a secret letter discovered at the Vatican revealed the truth of what happens when you die. In the past, the church believed that a worthy soul would leave the body like a bubble at the bottom of a 7-Up bottle. The purer your soul, the higher into heaven you would float. But this letter overturned all that. It turns out life is a job, and your wage is $14.50 a day. When you die, you go through a long, dark tunnel, and at the end of it, there is God, waiting for you, and he pays you your money. But there's a catch. He counts up all your sins, and you have to pay for them right there. Maybe you've heard that expression, you have to pay for your sins, Sarducci would say. That's the truth. You do have to pay for your sins. In cash. Steal a bag of potato chips when you're a little kid? $6. Each time you lied? $10. And so on. I always thought the bit was hilarious, but two stories in the news this week made me think of it, and neither is funny. The first was a report out of the Vatican. Bishop Marcelo Sanchez Sarando told a Spanish-language Catholic newspaper that right now, those who are best implementing the social doctrine of the church are the Chinese. In China, he said, the economy does not dominate politics, as happens in the United States, something Americans themselves would say. This came on the heels of the Vatican's decision in December to order two underground Catholic bishops in China to step aside so government-approved bishops could take their place. The Church, desperate to restore official relations with Beijing, is apparently willing to render unto the Caesars of the Politburo not only what is theirs, but what is God's as well. Sarando's comments were especially galling because they amounted to nothing less than bearing false witness. He went on at great length about how the Chinese do not have shanty towns and Chinese young people do not take drugs, thanks to China's positive national conscience. It's true that under China's state capitalism, hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty. It's also true that hundreds of millions still live in crushing poverty. The point is that Sarando admires the state part of the state capitalism, and the Chinese state's effort to promote a positive national conscience is decidedly at odds with any sane definition of Christian conscience. China has a vast network of slave labor camps. The state decides how many children citizens can have. It has an internal passport system barring minorities from foreign travel that would be instantly recognizable as a modern Jim Crow law if other ethnicities were in play. The second news item comes from a chilling article in The Atlantic by Anna Mitchell and Larry Diamond of the Hoover Institution. China is using cutting-edge artificial intelligence technology to construct a massive Orwellian surveillance apparatus to monitor every aspect of life. At home or work, everything Chinese citizens do on the internet is increasingly monitored and recorded. Outside, facial recognition software is empowering Big Brother to monitor where people go, whom they meet with, and what they buy. This will all be tallied into what Mitchell and Diamond call a citizen's score. Even being friends with a subversive could lower your score, thus encouraging people to stay away from dissidents for fear of losing privileges. An internet privacy expert says what China is doing here is selectively breeding its population to select against the trait of critical, independent thinking. This citizen score sounds an awful lot like Father Guido's Vita est Laborum. Work for the state, get a good score. Fail and pay the price. Fail and pay the price. But there are two key differences. First, Father Guido's bit was about getting into heaven, which the atheist government of China doesn't believe in. Second, Father Guido's idea was funny. This isn't. And from the local briefs, man recovering from stabbing. From Decatur, a 24-year-old man is recovering today from multiple stab wounds after being attacked in Decatur, police said. Sergeant Josh Sheets with Decatur Police said patrol officers found the victim half hanging out the passenger side door of a vehicle parked in an empty lot behind the 900 block of North Water Street about 1:30 a.m. Sunday. He had sustained 8 stab wounds and was taken to Decatur Memorial Hospital, said Sheets. We understand the wounds are not life-threatening. The victim's brother had been apparently trying to drag him into the vehicle with the intention of driving him to the hospital when police arrived after numerous witnesses had made 911 calls. Sheets said the brother was intoxicated and uncooperative while police worked the scene and tried to find out how the stabbing had occurred. The brother said there had been approximately 20 subjects that had attacked him and his brother, but he would not give any descriptions, added Sheets. He said he didn't know who did it. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, February 12th, 2018. Please stay tuned.